welcome into the Cultural Coven. I'm your host, Nicola Roy. I hope you're having a great start to the new year. Here at the Cultural Coven, we had some lovely news, which is that we are the Sunday Post newspaper's pick of the podcast. So thank you so much for tuning in and for your continued support. It really, really does mean a lot. And of course, thank you to our fab guests for bringing their sparkling chat. This is all still relatively new to me, so it really is lovely. Thank you so much. Anyway, back to this week's episode, which is a belter. Our guest is none other than Scottish poet, playwright, novelist and former MACA, or National Poet of Scotland. That's right, it is the brilliant Jackie Kay CBE. I first met Jackie through the Lyceum Theatre's artistic director David Gregg when her play Red Dust Road, adapted from her soul-searching memoirs about her life, was on here at the Lyceum, produced by the National Theatre of Scotland as part of Edinburgh's International Festival. And it also featured one of our previous Cultural Coven guests, the wonderful Elaine C. Smith. Jackie's writing is so beautifully lyrical. I've always felt drawn to it, and she also just happens to be a lovely person with the most fascinating life journey. An advocate for so many important issues, she's such an inspiration. Here we talk about her adoption as a girl of colour into a white family in Glasgow in the 1960s and 70s. We also talk about her being MACA of Scotland, some horrendous racism she has endured. We talk of her love of language and also some hilarious stories. If you are enjoying the chat, please do remember to leave us a wee review on iTunes. It really would go a long way to helping others find the coven. Go on, pals. And please do give us a follow on Instagram at Cultural Coven Pod and Twitter at Cultural Coven. Enjoy. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre. Hi Jackie, welcome into the Cultural Coven. I am a big fan of yours, so I am over the moon to have you here as a guest. How are things?
Oh hi, I'm delighted to be here. Yeah, things are fine. Things are okay. We're a sunny day in Edinburgh. I think Edinburgh suits the sunshine more than other cities in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about the sun in Edinburgh and the way that the lights hit the buildings and the way that the lights hit the hills. It's just really beautiful. It always lifts me up being in Edinburgh.
That's lovely. Well, we are very happy to have you in Edinburgh today. So Jackie, you are an award-winning poet, a playwright, a novelist, the former MACA or National Poet of Scotland. So you've done quite a lot, but was writing always your original ambition?
I don't think it was. I think I always wanted to be an actress.
Oh, okay.
So when I was a kid, I wanted to be an actress. And so from 12 to 16, I went along to these classes at the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama, RASMAD. And so I'd go on Wednesday afternoons and Saturday mornings. And I was really, for 6 years, so I was really obsessed and I loved it. But I would never get parts when I went for auditions for things. And so that was always perplexing to me. So I remember going for an audition once to the play of Miss Jean Brodie. And this woman saying to me, "You're really good, dear. You just did on colour." And she just came right out and said that. And that kind of was shocking, but it also kind of explained to me why I wasn't getting any parts. So then I decided that that I would write.
Oh, Jackie, well, their loss. I mean, I think you'd make a wonderful Miss Jean Brodie. I really do. Would you be interested in doing a bit of acting?
I'd love it. Creme de la creme.
David Gregg, if you're listening, I think you have your next production and your next actress.
I'd probably be a bit of a ham actress, but I mean, I'd just love to get a chance to try and to see whether or not I could do it. Just because, you know, I'll be 60 soon and it's quite nice to think of all the things that you haven't done that you'd like to do.
Yeah, as you say, you're going to be 60 this year. How are you going to celebrate that, Jackie?
I'm going to keep it quite low-key. But I'm going to celebrate all year. Because I think when you hit a decade, you should really have birthday celebrations for an entire year.
Well, I think you should be celebrated, Jackie. Were your parents supportive of your writing career?
Yeah, hugely. They couldn't have been more supportive. I think they they were not only supportive, but they sort of, they spoke in such colourful and interesting ways that they probably made me into a writer. You know, I think you become a writer or you are a writer long, long before you're a writer, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like a conundrum. something to get your head around. But yeah, I think most writers are writers before they've actually written a word, in the sense that they observe people differently, they listen into things. They might be the kind of nosy kid that's listening at the top of the stairs while their parents are downstairs, or they might just notice things differently when they're sitting on a bus or at school. You're already starting to see things in a kind of slightly outside way. And I think I did that from a really early age, and I had a mum who was very imaginative and who liked to do the same thing. So even though she didn't actually write, she was like a writer. So she'd say things like, "You never know what's going on behind closed walls, Jackie." And although we were in this kind of suburban street, the whole street was full of intrigue. And so-and-so met so-and-so at the AA meeting. Fancy that. And neither of them knew that either of them was going to the AA meeting. So you'd have things like that, and everything became really... And she'd always speak in this kind of quite a low, slow voice when she was imparting something dramatic to you, you know. So that was always quite exciting. And she'd say, "Listen, don't tell anybody that I'm telling you this, but..." And so you'd be hooked. You'd be leaning in. And my dad also had a very colourful way of speaking. So I think, I first became a writer just by listening to the way that people speak.
I love that sort of very Scottish thing, like, that you just said, "Don't tell anyone, but..." And then they've got a tale to tell you. And of course you're going to tell someone. What I so admire about you, Jackie, and your writing, is that it's beautifully intimate and honest. It's warts and all stuff, and often told with great humour. And I think people might feel like they know you because you're so wonderfully open. Some writers don't reveal themselves, but you do. Does using yourself as a vessel come naturally to you, or was that a route that you were directed down by others?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think I use myself in the way that a painter might, like Frida Kahlo. So I do different kinds of self-portraits. The interesting thing is, when you're a writer and you use yourself in some way as a springboard to jump into something else, or actually to write about your life or the people in it, people often assume that you're writing much more autobiographically than you actually are. They don't somehow make it creative or artistic in the way that we accept with art, you know. So we don't think with Frida Kahlo that her returning to her face over and over again is somehow limiting. But somehow we can do that with writers. So I find that fascinating in a way, because it's almost like I had to write about myself because there was nobody else telling my story. Mm. There was nobody else that was telling a story of a black person like me, brought up in a time like mine in the Scotland that I grew up in. I write as a kind of, as a representative,
yes,
of other people that might have felt like they were on the outside of things. Because we all have different imaginary versions of ourselves, and we all often have different imaginary versions of our parents too, particularly if they've got divorced or if we've lost one young. We kind of keep them going beyond the points at which they've stopped, because they keep going in our heads. And I find that relationship, the imaginary relationship to the making people up, even people that are real people that were close to us, there's still an imaginary version of them. And when you're adopted, you get introduced to that idea very, very early on. So
growing up, just even though I was brought up by my birth mum and dad, I still imagined things like, what if I was brought up by a king and a queen? So I imagine that you might have had a vision of what your birth parents were like. Did you, and when you met them, how did those two things marry up?
It's a lovely question. I did have an imaginary version of them both that kept changing as I changed and as I grew up. So if I think back to myself as a child, my mum used to love trying to imagine my birth father, who was from Nigeria, And she'd say to me things like, I'm picturing a Paul Robeson figure, Jackie, maybe with a bit of Nelson Mandela mixed in. And then she'd always have, you know, she kept on changing him. And sometimes he was very tall and he had big hands, big feet. And she, because we didn't know what height I'd be, because if you adopt a child, you don't really have a clue. I mean, I think I still think I'm tall, even though I'm not, I'm wee, but I think I'm tall because my mum kept telling me I was going to be tall when I was wee.
Dare she let you down on that?
Yeah, I haven't got my head around that. I'm 5'2" and a half. But yeah, and then with my birth mother, I imagined that she was like a Shirley Bassey for ages. So every time I saw Shirley Bassey singing Goldfinger on the telly, I think that's her. And then I found out that she was a white nurse from the Highlands, so I had to kind of change her again. And so yes, they went through several changes in my head. And actually, one of the things that I found the most difficult about finding my real birth parents was that I lost my imaginary ones. And although that might seem a crazy thing to say, I kind of grieved for these imaginary ones because they were better, better for me, kinder, more benevolent. And the whole experience with the imaginary version was very different.
Oh, my observation when I've seen you out and about with your adopted parents, who I know you sadly recently lost, was that you had this fantastic relationship, and I witnessed it in Redrush Road, the play about your life here on at the Lyceum. Do you believe that people are chosen, that you were meant to be with that family?
Yeah, I definitely do. My mum always used to say, you know, we chose you, other people had to take what they got, which I think a lot of adopted parents tell their children, because they fear, they've got an instinctive sense that child might feel rejected, to know that their original parents couldn't keep them for whatever reason. But my mum always used to have this kind of positive spin on it. But actually, I really do feel like I chose them. So that's even more bizarre. But I think that, you know, if I'd been kind of looking down at an orchard of parent trees before my spirit came into being, I would have picked them. And I'm not particularly religious nor particularly spiritual, but I like the image that I might have picked them before I materialised into me.
That is beautiful.
And strangely, when I met my birth mother, because she was a Mormon, and she told me the first time I ever met her, so I was 26 that first time, she said to me that the Mormons believe that babies that are adopted cry out to be adopted while still in the womb, which at 26 was really shocking to me and a shocking concept. You know, I just imagined myself inside the womb knocking, going, "Oi, get me another ma," before you've even formed a fist or a fingernails or anything.
Get me out of here.
Get me another, before you've got eyebrows or anything. But anyway, I thought it was, you know, I remember being really shocked at that idea and upset by it, really, because it was too convenient, you know, to kind of shift the responsibility for the whole thing onto me. But in another way, I kind of like the idea. I like the idea that we all like the idea of choice where there is none in our lives. We like to retrospectively think that there's choice when there wasn't.
Oh, I appreciate that. It must have sounded and felt like shifting blame. But I would also like to think that you did choose in some way that is true, because it's quite a beautiful thought, really. You get to choose who you're meant to, who's meant to be your parents.
And it's such a lottery when you're adopted. You know, you could have been brought up in an orphanage. You could have been adopted by any number of different people. You could have been, anything could have happened to you.
Absolutely, you could have ended up anywhere. So I had the pleasure of meeting you a couple of times, Jackie, one of which was at the press night of Redrush Road. I was there with Liz Lockhead and the actress Leslie Hart, and I also met your lovely son, Matthew. And whenever I think of you, Jackie, my brain throws me this image of your beaming smile, your radiating warmth and laughing. But I know we can all fake it. Are you one of the rare, positively balanced, glass always half full artists in the world, Jackie? Or do you have days like the rest of us?
Oh, no, I definitely have days like the rest of us. I think we have, you know, we all have a public and a private self, and we all are a mixture. We're all kind of Jekyll and Hyde. We're all happy and sad. I have got a lot of joy in me, and I always try and see the positive, even in the negative things. And I probably always do use humour as a form of defence, really, apart from anything else. It's a way of coping, humour, with difficult things for me. And so a lot of my writing is very funny, and the very funny things come from actually very painful things. I think it's kind of odd if you are a public person in the sense that you are recognised by people out and about in the street. You feel like you must represent yourself well, which is a funny thing, you know. It's not like you're a brand or anything, but it's more like that if people come up to you and say all sorts of lovely things, and it's really nice because they're making that step to say that to you. So you want to be able to be open to that, and that often cheers you up. They won't know what kind of state you're in before that, and we all have states that nobody knows what kind of state we've been in. So I think we're very complex human beings.
Absolutely. Those moments remind me of like a first date. You know, when you meet a stranger, you want to sort of sell your best self and show them your positive, smiling, lovely self.
Yeah,
it's my first date experiences. Jackie, do you have a particular writing process?
It varies a lot, you know, depending what I'm writing. So, because I write across different forms. So if I'm writing a poem, I often always write poems in notebooks first. Whereas if I'm writing prose, I write straight onto the computer. If I'm writing a poem, I can travel and write a poem in a train or something. But if I'm writing prose, like a whole chapter of a novel, I need to be kind of locked up, sort of in a cellar or an attic. So I find that poetry is more portable than prose, but less biddable. So I can make myself sit down and write a chapter, but I can't necessarily make myself write a poem. It's more like a poem has got a more mysterious something to it, and you've just got to be patient, wait for it to come, and sometimes you might go for a wee while without writing one. If I'm not writing at all, I don't feel like myself, so I feel like I'm something's wrong with me. I might actually even feel slightly ill because I need to be, and it's not really a case of writing to show anybody or writing to fulfill something. It's more that I need to be engaged with myself creatively to feel fully myself. So that's interests me. So sometimes I go through periods of fallow periods of not writing, and then I have to try and practice crop rotation. So if I'm writing, say, a novel or trying to, and I can't get it to work, then I'll rotate and try and write a poem instead and come back to the other project in the meantime. So I kind of like to spin things but at the same time, I really, really feel that all writers, that's why we have kind of so much discussion and fascination with writer's block. Writers need fallow periods just as well as fertile ones. They need periods where they're thinking about things and trying to work things out. But it's just that within these fallow periods, there can be a lot of uncertainty and anxiety and worry as to whether or not you even still are a writer. So in that way, it's a very peculiar job, because in other jobs, you don't think, oh, God, am I a doctor anymore because I haven't seen a patient yesterday, you know, for 2 weeks, or am I still a carpenter because I haven't made a table? Writers, I mean, it's just more linked. It's a game of psychology, really. So in that way, it's probably more like football.
I think that's really an interesting point, because I think it's something a lot of artists have been grappling with for the last 18 months. Am I still a writer? Am I still an actor if I'm not doing that at the moment? And I found it fascinating how much self-worth I must attach to my job, because when I'm not doing it, I feel utterly rubbish. But I think what you have said is a really healthy point, is that there's no bad thing sometimes about having a little bit of distance from it, whether that's to overcome blocks or just to kind of renew anyway. So Jackie, you were brought up in the 1960s and 70s in Bishop Briggs, which I believe was considered quite a posh area of Glasgow. Do you feel posh, Jackie?
No, I don't feel posh at all because my parents are very working class and I was brought up to identify with being working class, and also they didn't have any money at all. So like my mum made all our clothes. I never got a school uniform bought, never got to go on school trips, and they were always kind of counting money up from party jumble sales and bazaars and things to cobble together enough money because my dad worked full time for the Communist Party. So
yes.
So although we had this house in quite a middle class area of Glasgow, the nickname for Bishop Briggs is actually Spam Valley, and that's because they say that everybody's so busy buying their wee Lawrence houses that they can't afford to eat properly, so everybody in Bishop Briggs eats Spam, which Bishop Briggs people hate that story, but it's I like it because I find it very funny.
So you mean you didn't eat caviar with your glass of Iron Brew?
It was Spam and tripe all the way, Nicola.
So as you mentioned there, Jackie, your dad was a member of the Communist Party and I believe stood to be an MP. Were you quite political as a child?
Yeah, I was very political as a child. I mean, I was brought up going to marches. In fact, the minute they adopted me, I've got a picture of me aged 5 months, which is the age that they got me, on a demonstration. And Hugh McDermott is pushing my brother in the pram and my mum's just walking along carrying me. It's in a newspaper.
Oh.
But it's, I thought, bloody hell, got me adopted and straight out on a demo. Yeah. So, and I remember as a kid, I used to go to my dad's counts, where, you know, you'd get like 257 votes or something. And you'd walk up, you'd be out late really at these counts. I found them very exciting, and you'd meet old Tories like Teddy Taylor. I remember stopping and talking to me for ages one time, and my dad being really impressed, saying, "Teddy Taylor was talking to you," and he was really like, but I'd get kind of dressed up in my red trouser suit, and then people who admired my bell bottoms, I'd be quite pleased. But yeah, I used to find the whole business of being involved in either marches, demonstrations, rallies for Upper Clyde shipbuilders, or concerts for Chilean refugees. I'd learn lots of songs, you know, Venceremos, and I'd know all of these different. I'd know about all of these different things that were happening around the world: apartheid in South Africa, Angela Davis in America, Pinochet and Allende in Chile. And so it was quite an education.
Incredible.
For me.
Imagine a sort of a rich household for a writer to grow up in.
Yeah, massively rich household. And yeah, but so I remember becoming a young communist, taking a party card age 16, and then age 18, leaving the Communist Party. And so my dad had a brief period of happiness for 2 years. And I left the Communist Party at age 18 because I didn't feel they took feminism seriously enough.
Okay.
And nor did I feel that they took racism seriously enough. And I remember there was a house in Paris where the communists threw out a lot of black people that lived in this house. And I was really outraged at this. And I couldn't believe that the party in this country didn't call it out for what it was. So I remember leaving and becoming more radical than my parents for a long time and being, you know, going into my really angry phase.
And was that a bone of contention for you and your father then, if you were aware of these racial issues and he was still a member of the Communist Party?
Yeah, I think it was at the time. If I think back to the time, yeah, we had lots of arguments about things. But he was always somebody who liked an argument. I mean, that's politicians. Politicians, unlike the rest of the population that live in fear of arguments and are distressed by them, politicians relish argument, they relish debate, they relish different points of view. One of the saddest things actually about these times that we live in now is that debate and different points of view are being so squashed. And I think it's really, really healthy for people to be able to say, no, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with you in this way. And put your point of view forward, whether it's about an issue like euthanasia or whether it's about an issue like abortion or whatever the issue happens to be. I think it's always really healthy to have different sides to things. And my parents really did bring me up to have my own opinions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'd have arguments, but they were really healthy.
Yes.
Arguments about things. I think they also really, really changed because of some of the things that I said to them. They had to think differently. And that was quite an extraordinary thing. So, for instance, you know, when I was 16, I said to my mum, how would you feel if I were to tell you that I was a lesbian? I felt I must ask the question in the conditional because I wasn't bold enough to say, Mum, I'm a lesbian. And she said, I would be very upset. And I said, why? And she said, because you would be becoming something I don't know or understand. You wouldn't be Jackie anymore. And I said, I would. And this idea really kind of frightened me at 16. And then years later, like only a few years ago, really, my mum said to me, Jackie, out of the blue, Jackie, I want to apologise to you. And I said, why? And she said, because all these years ago, when you told me that you were a lesbian, I wasn't supportive enough. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have friends who had lesbians for daughters, and I just ignored it, and I didn't properly get behind you like I wished I had. And I was really moved by that, and I turned to my dad and I said, Dad, do you feel bad that you didn't support me? And he went, no! What else were we supposed to do? And I really loved it. I loved the fact that he was going, no! And that she was saying, you know, I just kind of loved the fact that they were both different like that. Yeah. It's such an enormously moving thing when people change with you because they love you, not necessarily because of anything else.
Yeah, yeah. Was there another occasion that you told your mum and dad, look, I am a lesbian, and were they then accepting?
No, I don't think I did return to it. I think I just got on with my life and assumed that they knew it by bringing successive partners to the house. I didn't actually, for years, from 16 to 26, have another discussion. I think the next big shocking thing for them was me telling them that I was pregnant, because they just got their head around me being a lesbian. And then it was really shocking to my mum, I think particularly because she hadn't had a child biologically herself, so, and had tried for 5 years to have a child. And so it was then very shocking that this kind of lesbian should come along and kind of get pregnant first time. But I remember her saying to me, how did you do it, Jackie? Did you use the syringe or did you do it the normal way? And I said, oh, I did it the normal way, quote unquote. And she went, oh, that's good, because the syringe is much too cold.
Oh my God, she sounds a hoot. The Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer, Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune. So you were adopted as a baby by a white Glaswegian couple, and I know you were very close to your mum and dad. I'm really sorry to hear of their recent passing. I know that must have been very hard for you. From everything I have read or seen of yours, I get such a sense of a happy home. I'm aware, though, that Glasgow would have been a predominantly white city in the 1960s and 70s, and I know that you have been quite open about the fact that you suffered horrible racism at school. Did the school deal with that, Jackie?
Yeah, they did. The school, I went to Balmoldy Primary School in Bishop Briggs, and we had a really wonderful, though fierce and frightening, headmaster called Mr. Thompson. There were three kind of bullies that used to wait at the school gate for me for 3 weeks on a trot and just make these sweets that they made up of mud. And then they'd wrap bubblegum wrapper around them, and then they'd get me in the ground and shove this mud into my mouth and say, that's what you should eat because you're from a mud hut.
Oh my God.
And that went on for, at least 3 weeks. And I didn't tell my parents because I used to not tell people things because I felt a bit embarrassed, actually. I think about that a lot now. I think, why should somebody attacking me be embarrassing? But actually, I think a lot of people share that feeling of being embarrassed when they're attacked. And then when I did eventually tell my mum, she was down at the school, and then one boy, the ringleader, was actually expelled from the school, and the other two were given the belt, and I was brought down to the headmaster's office because he wanted me to watch them being given the belt, which I found very traumatic. I don't know how he thought that was good for me.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't. I mean, I can see myself right now and exactly when I was standing in that room and see the belt come down in that boy's hand. And but at least they did in the primary school take it seriously, more seriously than they did at the university that I went to, Stirling, later when I was actually, you know, attacked by fascists and they put posters up with my name in them and razor blades behind the posters. Stirling University at that time were only bothered about not having their reputation destroyed any further, because they'd become known as the university that where students had thrown tomatoes at the Queen. So they wanted to just hush it all up, and that was much more important to them than actually dealing with the racists. My primary school headmaster was good, but I've thought really a lot. I mean, obviously I'm 60 now, and in the course of my life I've had lots of different experiences of different kinds of racism. And I think, you know, that it's very important for people to call racism out.
Yes.
And that the people that call racism out shouldn't all be black, that white people and white people that want to be actively anti-racist should also find ways of being actively anti-racist. And I think that one of the things that I found really uplifting about last summer's explosion of Black Lives Matter protests was that there were many, many more white people on those demonstrations than had ever been seen before on anti-racist demonstrations in the history of the world.
Yeah, as you were touched on there, during the pandemic, we had the Black Lives Matter movement, triggered by some horrendous deaths of black men at the hands of the police. But I then despaired when out came the Neanderthals responding with scandalous hashtags of All Lives Matter. And I started asking myself, are we digressing? What do you think, Jackie? Or do you think we are moving forward?
I think that, you know, history is interesting and that we have a pendulum swing. And I think sometimes when the pendulum swings for progress, it will actually, if it swings quite high up, it will come back again. That's what history is. It's a process of having a few steps forward and steps back and forward and back. And I think, you know, when I grew up and I would be on these anti-racist demonstrations and then take my son on Free Nelson Mandela ones, and he was like two in his pram when Nelson Mandela was freed. I think that we all believed that racism was a battle that we could actually fight and win. And I think now I don't sadly think that. I think that people have different, that racism is a kind of toxic poison in our world, and people have invented new ways and old ways to be racist. And so sometimes it's very, very disheartening, very upsetting that people have such a negative reaction to progress, and that people feel defensive, spiteful, angry, you know, the kind of thing that White Lives Matter over a football, I can't remember which football team it was, that you took the opportunity to spray that White Lives Matter right across the pitch from the air. I think that kind of reaction is troubling and worrying, and that people need to be educated, really. Because there's a resentment in this kind of term woke, and using cancel culture as a kind of lazy term for anybody that's actually saying, no, you know, this isn't on. I think I think we've got ourselves into a very, very complicated political situation at the moment, with so many different issues.
Yes.
And we're living in quite a corrosive, toxic time. And I think that people are also scared to speak, in case they're kind of, people shout them down because there's so much bitterness and hatred on social media, and so many anonymous trolls, that we live in a world that's barely, you could barely imagine that. I mean, I couldn't have imagined, although I was bullied at school and actually beaten up, at least I could see the fist and I could feel the boot. I think that for kids nowadays to be trolled anonymously and to have cartoons of themselves and to have, it's so intolerable, because they're bringing the bully into the house on their own phone. They've got the bully in their back pocket and in their bag. They go to sleep with it by their bedside, charging the bully. They're actually charging it up, and that's how kids are living. And it's unbelievable to just try and conceive of that. And it's no wonder we've got so many young people in our society now and across the world with so many mental health problems, because there is no escape.
Yes,
there's no escape.
Yes.
I could shut my door and go away and write a poem. And for me, my imagination was my escape. I had the sanctuary of my own imagination. That was a kind of a den. So I could go in there and write a revenge poem. You know, it's very hard for kids now to find a form of escape.
Oh my goodness, yes. And you made so many great points there. But you are absolutely right. The responsibility to challenge racism should never fall to people of colour. It has to, white people have to be challenging this, whether it's calling out your grandparents or reconsidering the things that you say yourself. On that point, Jackie, you are a wonderfully culturally inclusive person. And in 2016, I watched the footage of you reading the poem Threshold, the first poem you were commissioned to write as Maca of Scotland or National Poet for the reopening of the Scottish Parliament. I actually watched that footage again last night and it had the exact same effect. I was crying with pride. You capture Scotland's, her imperfections, her history, culture, changing faces, possibilities, and then rightly at the end, you land that she belongs to everyone that lives here, with lines such as, "This is my country and mine," said the Polish deli worker. Were you given a synopsis to write that, Jackie, or were you given free rein?
That's lovely. Thank you, Nicola. I was given free rein. I was given no synopsis at all. I chose to go into Parliament myself and look at the building and ask to be given guided tours by lots of different people that work there, because I wanted to see the building from the different points of view. So I think I had about six or seven different tours by people that had been there for ages, you know, all sorts of different people. And then I learned quite a lot about the way that the building was designed, the designer, the Donald Dura Library. And I tried to think, how could I, and Brexit was happening around that time, 2016. And so I wanted to write a poem that was showing that Scotland was a welcoming country. And then I kind of fixed in this idea of doors. And so the poem kind of begins with doors, you know, wee doors that you come into, all the different doors that you encounter in your life. And then through the kind of metaphor of doors, I was able to write the poem. But yeah, it took me quite a while to do, and I kept showing them different versions of it, and they were really pleased.
It was incredibly moving, and quite frankly, if that poem has not been read out in nurseries to nursing homes, it should be. It doesn't matter where you're from. If you live in Scotland, Scotland should be yours, or should feel yours. I also observed that you wrote it with and delivered it with quite an infectious rhythm that gives those words extra punch. Do you feel rhythms when you're writing, Jackie?
Yeah, I feel rhythm. Yeah, definitely. It's all about the rhythm. It's all about how it sounds and the beats and the meter. And I think I used to write when I first started writing when I was 12, 13, I would write poems to particular rhythms. So, you know, I grew up listening to the blues, and so I'd write poems to 12 bar beats, and I'd write poems to different musical rhythms, to folk songs, and you know, all different rhythms. But that was, yeah, because poetry, well, it is rhythm. It's one of the things that poetry is. And I'd like poets that I came across at the time when I was 16, like Liz Lockhead, who had a great sense of rhythm to her lines.
Yes.
And would turn on a pin. And so like a poem of hers, like My Little Sister, she's competent at Peaver. There'd be this rhythm underneath it. So you'd get this sense of her little sisters and the shoes and the walking. And I liked the idea that you could disrupt rhythm, that it didn't have to be dum-de-dum-de-dum-de-dum, iambic pentameters, that you could have rhythms from the ordinary speaking voice, the Scottish speaking voice. You could have repetitions and rhythms that captured that. So yeah, I guess that's some of what I've been trying to do.
I always think that some of the Scottish language has words that are quite onomatopoeic, and does that lend itself to poetry?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think we're so lucky. We've got such a rich language, and there's so many different parts of the country that have words associated with them. You know, so quine and loons is lovely, the idea of a quine and a loon for a girl and a boy in Doric. And it's really lovely, the idea of different words feeling, I mean, they're almost chewable, some of the words that we have. A slamash is a great word, or a sassenach, and a blether. I just like how invigorating a lot of Scottish words are, and how there's no exact equivalent. So if you say that somebody's looking glaikit, there's no exact English equivalent for a word like glaikit. I guess it means a face empty of all intelligence, or gormless is the nearest equivalent, but gormless isn't glaikit by a long chop.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes to find better words than those kind of old Scots words, I always think. You were made Maca in 2016, or National Poet of Scotland. You have a 5-year term, and I know that's just come to an end, Jackie. Do you feel bereft in any way?
Oh, it's a lovely question, Nicola. I was Maca from 2016 to March this year. That's a good 5 years, and it was a great privilege. It's probably the biggest honour of my life, but I was also really happy to hand the baton on. I wouldn't have liked to be the Maca for life. Like, Edwin Morgan was meant to be the Maca for life, and then these things got changed after them, after Ted and after Edwin. I think it's right that these roles have time limits on them, because they're very... Yeah, just because I think it's good for people to get an idea of different people doing things differently. I love being Maca.
Liz Lockhead was telling me the story for her when the call came in from the First Minister's office, and she'd missed the call. When they were going to ask her to be Maca, she'd missed the call and she was away doing her messages and she was all flustered. And then she told them she'd been away doing her messages. Do you recall what it was like when you got that phone call?
Yeah, it was very similar to Lizzie's story. I've heard Lizzie's story about her messages as well. And with me, I was told that it needed to be by the phone because the First Minister was going to call at a certain time. And then the call didn't happen, and I was meant to be taking my mum and dad out for tea and a scone in the local garden centre in Torrance. So I thought, I can't be sitting around all day waiting for the First Minister to call. So I got them in the car, and off we went. And then, of course, the phone went. And so I had to pull the car up, you know, to the side. And the First Minister said, I'd like to ask. Well, yeah, I was told before that I'd have to address her as First Minister.
Okay.
So the person on the phone that was passing the phone on said, the First Minister's about to come on the phone, and can you please address her as First Minister? So she comes on the phone and she says, I'd like to invite you to be the new Maca, and would you accept? And so I kind of go, yes, First Minister. But then I'm a bit, unusually for me, completely lost for words. So I said, would you talk to my mum? And so I handed the phone to my mum, and my mum went, hello, Nicola. And that was great. So then we had the conversation, put down the phone, and my dad was in the back of the car, and he was very hard of hearing by then. He was 91. And my mum turned around to my dad and said, John, that was the First Minister on the phone. And my dad went, who? The First Minister? Who? So it turned into kind of a Brun sketch, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'll never forget. And then we went to the garden centre, we had our tea and scone, and then, yeah, life continued. And
oh, they must have been incredibly proud, and then celebrated with their scone.
they were. Oh. And then when I did read the poem in Parliament that day that you kindly mentioned, Thresholds, my mum and dad were actually there that day.
You address them in it, don't you?
Yes, that's right. And my mum called that because I say, good day, mum. Mum, good day, good morning, Helen and John Kay. And my mum called that democracy in a couplet. But that day when we got into Parliament, my dad, who only ever got like 257 votes or whatever, and never been an MP, he got into Parliament that day and he went, I've made it at last! And he's in his walking stick. So that felt really lovely, that he felt that the whole experience of coming into Parliament was also him making it at last, you know, that... And so that was, it was really lovely the way that we own our our family's pride.
You are a great Maka. And I'm going to move on to our creative challenge.
Oh, exciting.
So, Jackie, as we've been talking about some of your brilliant poems, as this is the Cultural Coven, let's call this creative challenge The Cultural Coven Has Been Stirred, because as the theatre is slowly reopening after 18 months of being dark, we thought it might be fun to give you a creative challenge of writing a wee poem to the theatre ghosts, such as Elle and Terry here at the Lyceum. There's no pressure for any length, but I'll just let you have a little bit of time to think and you let me know when you're ready.
So this was an interesting challenge, and I've scribbled down, this is like, I hope I can read my writing, because I've scribbled down really, really fast and I don't even know if it makes sense. So I've done it in 5 minutes flat, but here we go. Hasn't got a title yet, I'll read it. Mum, oh Mum, the lights are coming back on at the Lyceum, and it's time for you to take your pew or claim the centre stage like you did years ago in Christchurch when you played, who was it again, in The Bear, and someone wrote a glowing review in the local paper circa 1955. The seats are filling up again, and who said you should be quiet? You, Helen Kay and Ellen Terry. I can hear Dad calling, Ellen, and you both turn round at the same time, theatrically, a sweep. Whoever said ghosts don't like all the attention, or do not sit still, or dare to dream, or carry out a brand new ambition? The theatre of our loves, lives, still applaud the dead, and the dead have not gone quietly into this good night. The dead are gaining it loudly. Listen to their flapping at the final curtains, in between all the clapping, the bravos, the encores. For all our dead, we all want more. One more night, one more goodbye, one more full seat, one more to feel what? Complete.
Oh, Jackie, well done, thank you. That was beautiful. I'm tearing up here. That is absolutely beautiful. Wow. It feels like a love letter to the theatre, to the ghosts and to the people you've lost as well. Absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much.
My mum always wanted to be an actress, and she did used to, you know, she was in an amateur dramatics group when she lived in New Zealand, where she met my dad, and she kept these reviews of this play that she was in, The Bear. And she'd always get them out and read them. And we often used to do whole plays in bed. I'd get into a double bed with her and we'd read like Jamie the Sacks or whatever. And we'd do it, the whole play, for the whole of an afternoon. And I think that's where I got my love of doing parts in theatre from, because she had a kind of great sense of timing, comic timing and theatrical timing. And also a sense of slightly being watched. And my whole family were like that a bit, you know. So my dad would say to my mum, how are you, Helen Kay? I'm fine, John Kay. How are you? So they often use the double names, which a lot of people do. But yes, but when people do that, they're almost giving themselves a bit of pizzazz, you know.
They're performing. Wonderful. Jackie, we talk a lot about Scottish humour. So on that note, as we were saying, you were brought up in Glasgow. Do you think there's a humour unique to Glasgow?
Yeah, I mean, I think Glasgow humour is hilarious. I mean, I think Glaswegians are very, very, very funny. And you'd be hard-pressed to meet funnier people around the world than Glaswegians. Having said that, you know, I remember going to Nigeria and doing a reading in Nigeria, and some Nigerians coming up to me and going, how come your sense of humour is so Nigerian? and then you're in Glasgow, people say, yes, your sense of humour is very Glaswegian. I think that probably humour is an international language and it's spoken by many people, and that when things strike a chord, when somebody can recognise something, often something that's very culturally specific, mm-hmm. It will translate into another culture because they'll have the equivalent cultural specific thing. And I think when humour works. It does translate.
Do you feel connected to Nigeria? I know you went there to meet your birth father.
Yeah, I feel very Nigerian. I feel very connected to Nigeria. When I went there, and I've been there a few times, but when I went there, one of the times that I found the ancestral village, I felt as if my footsteps were already on the road up ahead of me, and all I had to do was walk into my waiting footprints. And so that was quite an extraordinary feeling. Yeah, I do feel that landscapes, certain lands, chime with the heart. Mm-hmm. And we, all of us, you know, whoever is out there listening, will have a particular landscape that rhymes with them or chimes with them, a landscape where they feel, I belong here. And it doesn't need to be necessarily a landscape that of your birth, or even it can just be a landscape that you feel a real affinity with. And we often don't know why we feel affinity for certain landscapes. It might be that there's memories in us that belonging to other people. We just don't know. But I do definitely feel an affinity with Nigeria. I feel an affinity with the Highlands in Scotland, where my birth mother was from. And when I'm ever in the Highlands and I travel there a lot, I mean, I'm all over the Highlands a lot, certainly as Macca. I was round and about and out and about a lot. But whenever I get a certain kind of light in the land, my heart soars.
Oh, lovely, Jackie. You just have such a way with words.
That'll be because I'm a writer.
Is that what it is, hen? I was like, she's quite good with words and that. I'd quite like to speak some of your words one day, Jackie. You're very good. Did you see much theatre growing up, Jackie?
Oh, yeah. I was so lucky because my parents practically lived in the Citizens. So I'd get to see every play that was on at the Citizens. But we also went to other theatres. So I'd go to Cumbernauld Little Theatre. And I remember seeing the Cheviot and the Stag and the Black Oil in the Cumbernauld Little Theatre. I went to Mull Little Theatre and saw Cold Comfort Farm there when I was really wee. And I'd go to other theatres. I remember seeing the Bevelers. I remember seeing the Steamy. I remember seeing all of Wildcat plays. Some of them took place at the Star Social Club. So I remember The Painted Bird made a huge impression on me with Terry Neeson, because it was about mental health, and there was this line in it where she goes to the doctor and they're talking about the average amount of kids, and he says 2.4, and she says 2.4 a wane. How can you get 0.4 of a wane?
That's a very good point.
And we used to go around and say that, and you know, you have certain wee family lines that become part of your private language. So whenever we kind of loved the theatre and going to see things, but we also kind of would take them back home and incorporate them into our lives.
If you could cast a cultural coven spell on Scottish arts and culture, what would it be, Jackie?
I would make sure that our theatres don't die. I would fight for our theatres. I would fight for our book festivals. I would fight for our music. I would fight to make sure that our vibrant cultural life doesn't get threatened by cuts or COVID or any other C that we might think to put in there. Because I think that if you've got a country where the culture is healthy, then the people are healthier. And one of the things that we've seen during this pandemic is that the more creative people are, the more they're able to cope with random things happening to them, like a pandemic coming out of nowhere. And the more that they can find a response in themselves that genuinely surprises them, where they can't go on tour, they can't go into theatre, they can't write in the usual way, they can't meet this person, they can't that person, what can they do instead? And you've found the most extraordinary creative outpourings that have happened from all around the world, from when we saw opera in the Italian balconies right through to badly drawn boy doing his new songs in his wee room. And I found that extraordinarily moving. It's made me think that they need to respond to big traumas culturally. It goes very, very deep in us. And it's not a luxury. It's a need. It's a necessity. As Audre Lorde said, the great African-American writer said, poetry is not a luxury. It's a necessity. And I've thought of that during the whole pandemic, of how necessary culture is in our lives and how bereft we all are without it.
Yeah, art makes the heart sing, I believe. What has become clear is how much everyone in the world can benefit from art and can feed off art. It gets us through some terrible times, or we can address some big questions via art.
Absolutely.
So, Jackie, I've talked a lot about your honesty in your writing, and one of your most well-known collection of poems is The Adoption Papers, which when published saw you rise in prominence. And for anyone who doesn't know these poems, they tell the story of a young black girl's adoption by a white Scottish couple through three different perspectives: the birth mother, the adopted mother, and the daughter. It's, to me, very brave and candid and beautiful. Were you apprehensive to put something that personal out there, Jackie?
I was at the time. I remember telling my dad that I was writing the book, and he said, "Have you no got a wee bit of a tip for yourself?" And I was really worried that my biggest worry was that it would be seen as an indulgence, and that it wouldn't speak to anybody outside of myself, or, you know, a couple of other people that felt like that. So I was really surprised when it was published, and it kind of sold out very quickly. And then it's still in print. It's never been out of print since 1991, and had a huge amount of people respond to the book, people that had been adopted themselves or had adopted brothers or sisters, or who'd given children up for adoption, birth mothers and birth fathers, or who'd had adoption as part of their wider family, or people that just been separated from parents in different ways. And I've had loads and loads of letters over the years, but I could have never anticipated that that would be the response.
Were you concerned about your adopted or birth parents' response to it in any way?
Not really with the adoption papers, because I wasn't worried about my birth mother, because at that time I hadn't met her. And so the mother in the adoption papers, birth mother, is completely imaginary. And I wanted her voice to be kind of ethereal. So she's got a much more lyrical, ethereal voice, and the adoptive mother's got a more down-to-earth, kind of earthy voice. And the daughter is somewhere in between.
You've also written poems for children, and they're beautiful and vivid. Does that come with a different responsibility, though, because you are, in some ways, maybe shaping the youth of Scotland?
I don't feel it does come with an extra responsibility, because I think that children are complex, and children experience grief, divorce, friends falling out with them, pets dying. You know, their lives are complex, and so I wanted to write children's poems that would speak to that.
Yeah.
And it was having a child myself that allowed me to start writing children's poems, because having a child yourself gives you a tiny wee magic key, and you open that tiny wee magic key back into the kind of locker of your own childhood, and things that happen to them remind you of things that happen to you. And so it's like a pass. But now that I've not got a child, well, now that he's 33, the children's poems have kind of dried up in me. So I can't really write children's poems at the moment. But I am about to write an illustrated children's book for littler children.
Oh.
And so that's very exciting.
Can you tell us what that's about?
No, I can't, because I don't know yet.
Okay, all right.
I've got lots of different ideas, but I haven't decided which one to light on.
It will land with you and you'll know, right?
I hope so. Mm-hmm.
So, Jackie, I know you've done some work with asylum seekers, highlighting their cultural contribution. How was that?
Yeah, it was really important. I had one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, because I met three different people and talked to them a lot about their experiences. And then I wrote three separate poems, and then the Scottish Parliament had an evening where lots of asylum seekers came to that evening. My mum and dad came as well. I've got a great picture of my mum with somebody else's kind of wrap in her head on, looking really dramatic with this big African wrap. We've got that on the mantelpiece at home. She loved it. And it was a great kind of welcoming night. And the people whose voices I tried to represent, I suppose, in these poems, and were just felt so validated by the process. But it was also a big learning experience for me, because one of the things that one woman mentioned, who was very shy, took quite a lot for her to talk, was that the constant fear never leaves you, and that when you're in an asylum seeker, you're just followed around by fear itself. It's this kind of nebulous, unseen thing that follows you. So there's a poem I wrote called Constant that was just trying to capture that idea of fear being everywhere, waking up with you, going to sleep with you, everything.
What a way to have to live. It shouldn't have to be that way.
You're such a sweetheart, aren't you?
I think you do such great work at shining a light on issues and situations that need it. You seem to use your profile and artistry in such a positive way to try and make a difference, and I really, really admire that about you, Jackie.
Thank you.
I think the arts is a pretty liberal world, so I'm always quite shocked, Jackie, when I step out of that bubble into a different industry and I find that people don't necessarily think as liberally as I maybe do. It's no secret that you are a lesbian. Was that accepted by those close to you in the business?
It's hard to remember. I think, you know, initially being a lesbian wasn't really very easy. But I always had jobs where, you know, I was always openly gay, so I was always just open.
Mm.
I just never thought, you know, I never really thought that hiding anything would be in anyone's interest. And I mean, I remember even in interviews, so when I used to do interviews way back, you know, 30 years ago, I used to get then a bit tired of everybody saying black, lesbian, Scottish, and that would be the headline. I remember doing an interview with the writer AJ Close where I said that. I was really tired of people saying that. And then next day in the Sunday paper, there was the headline, black, lesbian, Scottish again. And then my mum's mum, actually saw this, and she hadn't seemed to realise that I was a lesbian, even though I'd taken successive girlfriends round to her house for gingerbread and cups of tea and ginger wine. And she phoned my mum up that morning and she says, "Does her father ken about this?" And my mum said she felt she had to go off and have a wee brandy at 11 in the morning because she felt as if she was coming out as a mother of a lesbian to her mother. And then her mum said at the end of it, my gran said, "Ah, well, there's one thing, no many people read that big paper." because it was a broadsheet, not a tabloid. But yeah, I remember the feeling that people initially in the kind of 80s, the early 80s, would be shocked because they would have in their head an idea of what a lesbian looked like or what a lesbian would be like, how she would dress and what age she might be. And there was all sorts of kind of stereotypes, and those stereotypes didn't include me. It was almost always white. It was almost always dungareed. It was almost always short, kind of spiky hair. And there was a kind of a look that people assumed. There wasn't a lipstick lesbian look then. And so, yeah, it was really hard to think, were there other people like me?
Okay.
And I think that was the thing that I felt more strongly, not really about how straight people saw me, but really how to fit in with other lesbians. And it wasn't really till I found a group of black lesbians when I went to this conference called OWAD, Organization of Women of African and Asian Descent, and I went there in 1980, so I was only like 20. And I met all these 50 other black lesbians, and that was kind of amazing because at one point I thought I might be the only one in the whole world. I hadn't met ND, I hadn't heard about ND, and I made this friends with people that are still my friends today.
Oh wonderful. I think people always kind of want to fit people in boxes, so they understand, oh, that's who they are, that's what they are. So as you said, black, lesbian, Scottish, I hate labels. Let's take those categories away. If you could choose a description, how people would think of you or remember you, Jackie, what would that be?
I guess I'd like them to remember me in whatever way they wanted to, if they wanted to at all. I don't really mind about how people remember me. I guess I'd like to think that they thought it was a good laugh.
You are. And a good writer.
As good sense of humour. And that I'm kind, yeah. I think I'm quite kind. So I'd like people to, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, they're the categories that matter.
These are the things that matter.
Yes, they're the qualities that matter. Everyone wants to pigeonhole people, though, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, the other day we went to scatter my mum and dad's ashes because, as you said earlier, they both died within, you know, a short space of time of each other, and there was something very beautiful about scattering their ashes in Rannoch Moor, where they were both climbers and they'd been in Craigdhu, and they spent a lifetime climbing and dancing and doing things that they really, really loved to do. And there's something lovely about building this cairn for them and thinking, you know, my son built it. It was very, very beautiful, these kind of stones from the garden. And I just thought, actually, I want a cairn. And so it wasn't so much how I'd like to be remembered. It was more that I thought I'd like to have a cairn. I don't really want to have a gravestone.
Mm.
I'd like the idea of having a cairn, something that fits into the natural landscape and something that looks like it's part of things, because I guess that's what I've tried to be all my life, part of things, even when people have told you can't be part of them.
Oh, Jack, yeah. That's much better than just a normal grave, right? Jackie, you have been awarded a CBE, but you don't have it yet. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think I'm to get it. I've asked to get it in Scotland at Holyrood House, so the Holyrood Palace, rather than Buckingham Palace. So yes, I think that's going to happen in January.
And I imagine you've met the Queen quite a few times in your role as Macar.
I have. I've also got an MBE before. So yeah, I've met her a few times. In fact, you know, I remember embarrassing myself when I got the MBE, because you're told all these things that you need to do, like step forward, step back, you know, curtsy, shake hands, and don't speak until you're spoken to, and say ma'am first, and say majesty this and whatever. And so I got kind of a bit confused because I was wearing high heels, and never wear high heels, so I felt kind of out of control of my body. So I was really focusing on the footwork. So when I got to her, I forgot all about the waiting to be addressed, and I just said to her, oh, hello, you look a lot like yourself. That's really embarrassing. But she seemed to take pity on me saying that. And then she chatted to me for ages about my children's poems, of all things.
Oh.
They give you, you know, you get a medal. So I had a medal for the MBE. And then I got a letter from them saying that they want that back. You had to post that back in order to get the other one, whereas you used to be able to keep them. But now I think that the cuts or whatever.
Did they recycle it?
I think they're melding them all down and then recycling them and making more. But I remember my mum saying, that's terrible. You mean you had to send your old one back? God, I've heard it all. Don't tell me any more.
Was it
my mum didn't want me to accept any medal in the first place, and she wouldn't come. So when I got the first medal and I had it in Buckingham Palace, I just went with my son and his and one of my best friends, because my mum and dad kind of refused to come. And my mum said, I'm no going to Buckingham Palace to sook up to the Queen.
Did she was she struggling with the monarchy, or was it the word empire? And
no, it was struggling with the monarchy. The word empire doesn't help, but for, I think, for a black writer, I think, you know, I know lots of, I was talking to Bernadine Evaristo about this the other day. I think that we all of us have different opinions. Obviously, some people refuse it because of the empire, but other people feel that they must take it because they know that actually the way that a whole system works is that people basically vote from communities, from literature communities, and if somebody's put your name forward from a whole load of different places, then and you say no, then you kind of waste a vote.
Mm.
So, and I also think, yeah, having CBE, I don't use it on letterheads or anything like that. But if you're fighting in a political cause and you've got something that you want to say, having that bit of extra clout can be handy.
Yeah, it's weaponizable, I imagine.
Yeah, it's clout.
I am going to move on to our quick fire questions, Jackie.
Good.
So I am going to give you some quick fire questions. All the big life questions, Jackie. They are the fundamentals on which I judge a person, so I feel judged. I will give you two options, and if you could fire back with your instinctive answer. Are you ready?
Yeah, I like playing games.
Good. TV or theatre?
Theatre.
Classics or contemporary?
Ooh, that's really tricky. That's very, very tricky. My God, because I feel like you have to have both. Sorry, can't choose. Do I have to?
If there was a gun to your head, Jackie, what would you go for?
Let's go for classics.
Cheese or chocolate?
Cheese.
Dull in Perthshire or hell and purgatory in Orkney?
Hell in purgatory in Orkney.
Robert Burns or Robert Ferguson?
Robert Burns.
Poetry or plays?
Poetry.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
Chippy sauce.
Yes. The Stalls or the Grand Circle?
The Stalls.
Five star or camping?
Five star.
Opera or ballet?
Opera.
Ghosties or no ghosties?
Ghosties.
Highland coos or just coos?
Highland coos.
Whiskey or wine?
Whiskey. Well, that's hard as well, but yeah, that's very hard, whiskey or wine. I like both. But if I had to have only one drink and I had to drink it every night, it would have to be wine then.
Oh, okay. Oh, controversial.
Yeah, because whiskey I only have sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. You can drink that every day. Like.
But whiskey, I love the characters of whiskey. Mm. Stories they tell.
Yeah, it's a different kind of, I always think it's a different kind of tipsiness, a sort of warmth. It's like a putting a blanket round you, I feel mm-hmm. like whiskey. Period dancing or stage fighting?
I thought you were going to say periods or menopause.
Well, what would it be?
I was going to choose the menopause. Oh, the bloody sanitary pads any day. Oh, what was it? Anyway, what was the actual question?
Period dancing or stage fighting?
Stage fighting.
Taggart or still game?
Still game.
And that concludes the quick fire questions. I think you passed with flying colours, Jackie. Oh, I think you're all right.
Thank you. That was fun. That was fun.
Thank you so much for giving up your time to come and talk to me. You are just such a wonderful, vibrant person to talk to.
Nicola, straight back at you, as they say in LA. No, you've been great to talk to. You're really fun.
Thank you.
Yeah, your mammy would be proud of you.
Oh, thank you, Jackie. That means a huge amount. Thank you. Well, I do hope to be seeing you next time in a theatre bar or maybe just in the auditorium watching a play.
Well, I'd love you to be in a play. Yeah, maybe I should write something for you.
I would love that.
What a woman. It was just such a lovely afternoon chatting to Jackie. She is so full of wisdom and fun. I hope you've enjoyed your time in the Coven with us. Please do remember to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Next up is Len Penny, an inspiring young woman taking the Scottish poetry scene, well, world, really, by storm. She's also a brilliant advocate for mental health. Len was recently awarded Scots Speaker of the Year and has built a huge following through her sharing of the Scots word of the day. Here in the Coven, we talk about everything from social media trolling that she has endured to Scottish identity and preserving the Scots language. A really fascinating chat. So it's bye for now from me, Nicola Roy. I hope you have a great week. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre, co-created by me, Nicola Roy, produced by Lee Kennedy, with sound and editing by Barry McCall, and musical support from Cameron Barnes.